This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Happy New Year and welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a push to protect people who pay rent from arbitrary eviction. A former NAACP chapter president wants the organization's nonprofit status revoked. And another former president will lead a protest at the NAACP's Image Awards in Los Angeles.
But first, a protest march against lynching is set for January 15th in Dover, Delaware. Dr. Jahi Issa is one of the organizers. Dr. Issa was a professor at predominantly Black Delaware State University in Wilmington until he was arrested and fired, stemming from a student protest.
One day before the student-led protest, the students had a rally regarding a flyer that was distributed throughout the Black community in Dover, Delaware, which depicted a Black man hanging from a tree. And it said, cleaning our streets one nigger at a time, with a Black man hanging from a tree with a rope around his neck. I was lecturing on lynchings. The students couldn't believe that this flyer was being distributed throughout Delaware. And they had a rally, and that's what led to the March the 1st protest. We got legal advice from the ACLU, in whom we tried to subpoena. We did subpoena them for the December the 4th hearing, but they filed a motion to quash our subpoena, and they refused to come and testify on my behalf, although they were representing myself and the students. I think some of it has to do with my advocacies about Black men hanging on trees in Delaware. Also, an article that I wrote called How Black Colleges Are Turning White. I know a lot of people in the listening audience may believe, wow, how could this possibly have any play? Well, if we look at what's happening with Fisher versus the University of Texas, where the Supreme Court is going to rule and probably end affirmative action at the majority mainstream white universities, where Black enrollment will probably plummet to less than 3 to 4% all around the country. And then all we have left basically for higher education is the historically Black colleges. And they are basically being ethnically cleansed, basically due to a Supreme Court hearing in 1992 called Fordyce versus the United States, where the Supreme Court ruled that all historically Black colleges must integrate. They didn't give a number. They gave the number of 5% and then later led it up to the states to decide. In states like Tennessee, they tried immediately to force enrollment of white students at Tennessee State University to 50%. And the federal government pays for this. They give extra money for white students and white faculty. So essentially what we're seeing is an attack on the Black middle class by ending our pursuit to higher education, which will give us the skilled jobs to basically take care of our family and resist white supremacy. And so I was dealing with two very important issues, this epidemic of Black men hanging on trees all over the country where they're being ruled as suicides by local officials, but families are saying that these are not suicides, not just in Delaware, but in California, in Maryland, in Indiana, in Mississippi, in Louisiana. I mean, these are serious issues, and I think in this post-racial world, the last thing they needed was someone of mine with my credibility talking about very important issues pertaining to Black people in this country.
For decades, Black organizations pressed for an anti-lynch law. We never got it. Looks like we need it now.
Yeah, and this is interesting because in Delaware, when Vice President Joseph Biden was senator in 2004, they passed Senate Proposition Bill 37, I believe, which basically said that the United States Senate apologized for the lynchings, recorded lynchings of more than 5,000 African-American men and women. But there's never been a law that tells those who do this accountable. And so I think this is something that people are talking about all over the nation, that we believe now is the time that we get the United States government to pass anti-lynching laws in this country. You know, what we have now is that these lynchings are being dubbed as suicides. And so we want to know if these are suicides, and we want the CDC, the Center for Disease and Control, to come in and investigate why all of a sudden black men are hanging themselves on oak trees.
Historically, lynchings and other atrocities were the domain of the NAACP, but no longer. Is anybody keeping track on these kinds of assaults on our community?
It's interesting that you bring up the NAACP. I am a member of the NAACP. And 3 weeks ago, we were at a state meeting with all the state leaders and the regional director, Mr. David Bean. He's over five states for the NAACP, and he sits right under Mr. Benjamin Jealous, was there. And when we started talking about lynchings, I guess he made a call to Mr. Ben Jealous, and he ran out of, literally ran out of the building, never to be seen again. He gave me his number before leaving earlier that day, but when I said he was really interested in looking into this, but when I tried to call him, he would just simply hang up the phone. It seems as though the NAACP, unlike 100 years ago when Du Bois was living, where they held an anti-lynching march, they're no longer interested in this type of activity. Of course, we live in a post-racial world, and these things should not be happening, but they are happening.
Sounds like we see some class issues at work as well.
It seems that way. It seems like these are serious issues of class, even in the state of Delaware. We've gotten very little support, mainly because one individual who was found hanging from a tree at a park in Dover, and another guy was attacked, and they tried to cut off his penis and his ear before he fought back and ran, and some European Americans saw what was happening and called the ambulance and the police. But these are poor African American men. And some of them have been in and out of the penal system. But around the nation, we're seeing that it's not just African-Americans of the lowest economic stratum of the country. We're finding college students at San Jose State in California in 2008. A young man was allegedly found hanging from a pipe in the basement of a white college fraternity. And the Department of Justice, under Eric Holder's office, said if they continued the investigation, it would be a threat to national security. So this is the type of attention that we're getting from the federal government. And I believe that this is not going to stop until African Americans themselves decide, particularly those of the grassroots, working class black folk, decide that enough is enough.
The criminal case against Dr. Issa remains in limbo.
On February 1st, hundreds of picketers may descend on the NAACP Image Awards festivities in Los Angeles. The protest was organized by Reverend Edward Pinckney, the former president of the NAACP chapter in the mostly black town of Benton Harbor, Michigan. Reverend Pinckney says the state NAACP sold out his chapter as part of a deal with the Whirlpool Corporation. He's also organized the burning of thousands of NAACP membership cards. We asked Reverend Pinckney how the Image Awards protest is shaping up.
It has been tremendous. I did not anticipate it would be like this. I thought I would get a lot of resistance from black people. I thought that they would say, no, you're doing the wrong thing. But I tell you, they have put an arm around me, and I tell you, I have to have three conference calls to deal with all the people who want to be part of it.
Well, we're familiar with your complaint against the NAACP, very specific complaint that they tried to unlawfully reconstitute your chapter. But what kind of complaints are you getting from people out there?
Oh, you name it. Pretty much the same thing. One of the things that I put out there is that, you know, the NAACP is misrepresenting our black community and the black people. And I think when I put that one out there, people start calling from all over. And one of the terms I love to use at the NAACP is pimping the black community. And I tell you, the response has been tremendous.
Have officials of the national NAACP tried to speak with you to head off this event?
Not at all. Not as of yet. I have not heard from them. One of the board members here from the state contacted me because he was a friend of mine, and he's telling me that we're making a lot of noise. He said, you're making a lot of noise, and he said he was a little concerned because it appears to be too much noise that we're making over this issue. I told him it wasn't just over my issue. I said, I am sick and tired of black people who claim to be black leaders coming to our community and kind of like neutralize us. That's what they do. I said, what they do, they neutralize black folks because they're supposed to be the voice of the black people. And when I think of the NAACP doing what they're doing, I am very upset. And he did not take that very well. He's saying that I should go after some of the white organizations. I said, if they get in my way, I'm going to run right over them too. And we're going to get some answers from the NAACP first. Then we'll worry about these other organizations.
Well, these white organizations don't claim to be accountable to black people.
Absolutely. And especially they don't claim to be a civil rights organization. So my question to him was that, what are you going to do now that you know this is going to happen? Well, he said that he's going to take it back to the board and tell them how serious I am about this. But it's not really me. It's everybody now. Just watching for everybody. But this group, I'm telling you, these ministers and everybody are really coming together to deal with the NAACP. And I think we're right on the money for some reason. I think that what we're doing now, we're going to even make the NAACP put up or shut up. It's beginning to really register around the community about what the NAACP is truly about. They no longer fight for civil rights. And we got to hold the NAACP accountable for their action and inaction. We can no longer pretend that they represent black people in this country anymore.
What's the count now with the burning of NAACP membership cards?
I am so glad you asked. We are at 3,947 cards. We are going to go over the 4,000 mark this Sunday. I'm happy today. I'm happy that people have finally decided that we're going to stand up. Because most of the time, like I said before, and I keep saying this over and over again, we give other black people a free pass. And that's why we're in such a compromising position today.
Reverend Edward Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
David Lowry was president of the Chicago South Suburban Chapter of the NAACP until he was suspended for questioning the organization ties to the Democratic Party. Lowry is now circulating a petition to revoke the NAACP's nonprofit status. He says the organization acts as a political advocacy arm of the Democratic Party and that NAACP Chief Ben Jealous was behind his suspension.
This whole thing started back on October 4th when I received a call from Lewis Raymond, who was one of the regional managers for re-election Obama campaign. He tried to convince me to use my branch to be able to disseminate information as well as get people registered to vote for the Democratic ticket in the upcoming election. After I refused to do that because I'm an independent, Mr. Raymond got upset with me and told me he had been watching me and that he knew everything about me as well as go on to say that they would deal with me and then hung up in my face. So I didn't know at the time who he was. I reported it to the police because of my position in being in a national organization like the NAACP. You run into some situations when you're trying to stand up and do the right thing. So we made a police report of it. WBBM Channel 2 got a hold of it. It went viral. And so the media was, you know, looking to interview me about the incident. So I did do a show on Sirius Radio, Robert Redding News Review. I did this on the 4th, and so I started talking about the issue on what happened. I spoke to the state president, George Mitchell, and told him what happened as well. After that show aired, maybe 6 or 7 days later, that was when I was supposed to be suspended, when Ben Jealous heard it. But this is what actually happened. The show had aired, and then They did hear it, but they came at me with a cease and desist letter. And I had already complied with that. I talked to state president and told him, man, you know, I hadn't said nothing that was out of line. Everything I said was true, that President Obama has not addressed any type of issues in the black community, such as economic development, employment, and education, and all the other things that the situation we face every day. He hasn't said one word. And so when the state president heard the WBBM clip, he sent me a letter telling me to cease and desist as if I was trying to hurt President Obama's reelection accomplishments and all that kind of stuff. So I sent him a letter back stating, you know, I'd adhere to it, but my freedom and right to speak is my own and cannot be dictated by the NAACP national office. So the word was getting around. Other people was calling me about interviews. And so when Ben Jealous finally did hear it, that was when they ordered me to be suspended. But that wasn't what they suspended me about as well. They was looking for something. And when I rebutted the fact that I had not been partisan to any party, because they firstly said that I was being partisan to the Republican Party by talking about Romney and not Obama. So when I dismissed that, then they came back and said that I was going to be suspended for supporting President Obama. So I filed an appeal, and I'm waiting to hear from that. But in the meantime, they've tried to conduct an election. And one of the guys, Gil Ford, who is over the membership branch, he and I have not been friends over the years. So they suspended me, plus my membership, so that I couldn't even run for office over the branch again. And after this incident happened, I did a news piece at Ready News again. I found out that there's been several other NAACP presidents who they've done this to that took a dead branch. I had 12 members when I started, and now the branch has swollen over to over 300. I've written legislation, House Bill 5665, that deals with illegal foreclosures here in the state of Illinois that is now at the Senate getting ready to go committee. We've gotten people jobs. We've worked with reentry people. We've done so many things out here in the Southland that have promoted equality and respect for the branch that I didn't quite understand what they actually wanted, because they didn't want that. We got no support from national. So I'm excited to hear back what the NAACP has to say regarding my appeal that I filed. And from there, after that, I hear from that, then I'll take this to the next level, because I'm recommending that people who have experienced the unaccountability of the NAACP in the black community, and yet they get millions of dollars to say that they're doing things, and that they cannot be partisan. And we all know for a fact that they are a political machine for the Democratic Party. So I'm getting a petition together, and you can go to my website at www.livingdrivingwildblack.net, and I tell people to sign the petition, and let's get the NAACP back to the table, because I'm going to request the RS revoke their national charter until they get themselves back to what it's all about, and that's freedom fighting for people of color.
In one of those interviews, you stated that the NAACP has gotten away from what freedom fighting is. Well, what are they about then?
Mr. Ford, I'm 55 years old, and I picked and chopped cotton in Arkansas until I was 8 years old. And back in the day, the NAACP had gained some kind of respect as far as fighting for civil rights for black people. That was legislation that they put forth to the Supreme Court with Thurgood Marshall, who laid a good foundation for this organization. But what they've become now is a big social club. You know, they rake in millions of dollars with all the sponsors who put nothing really back into the black community. They look the other way on major issues like racial profiling and police murder and brutality. They haven't, I mean, it's just a club to where now that if you got some money that you can be a part of, and it's a way to control black people and keep them voting for the Democratic Party, which is not doing nothing for black people in the communities across the country.
Well, Ben Jealous goes to the White House anytime he feels like it, and he participates in rallies that look and sound very much like Democratic Party rallies. But you can't say a mumbling word about anything, can you?
Well, they came back and said that I was suspended because I supported the president on my talk show. I have a talk show called Let the Truth Be Told. It's every Thursday on intellectualradio.com, and took some comments from that to say that I was being partial toward the president, which, you know, it really infringes on my First Amendment rights, freedom of speech. I give the disclaimer every time I'm on the show that I'm not speaking as the NAACP president nor the Living and Driving While Black Foundation. So I just think that they was looking for something to shut me down because the word was getting around on how this staffer that President Obama was trying to sort of use strong-arm tactics or intimidate me to get the press to support him. But Ben is so far off. First of all, to me, he's really too young to understand what the civil rights struggle is to be in a position of that nature. His main motivation is to link the NAACP with the fraternities and the sororities, and they really not doing nothing out here. The NAACP is supposed to be on the ground at the grassroots levels addressing the issues of the people, not the issues of self. So Ben is way off course. He should have never been the president because he don't even know how to freedom fight itself. And that's why the NAACP is always last to the fight. When in back in the day when we had real leaders, they would be the first one to throw the first punch.
And getting plenty of corporate sponsorship all along the way.
All the way. And I mean, this is one of the most disheartening things about the branches. And this, I think this is what killed them. I just got a call today from a lady who was here in Chicago, and she had been calling the Southside branch for 3 months and never got a call back. For the first time today, she called us. I think we called her in 3 hours, and she was so impressed about that. But when I told her that I was leaving, she decided to leave with me. So she was complaining because people don't get the response. And the national office doesn't support the branches. It's really like the national office is a pimp because you have to pay compliance fees, off the membership, every membership. The branches get $11.90, and the branch get $18.10. I'm going with exact figures now. Then you add that if you have a Freedom Fund dinner, they get a percentage of maybe 40 to 50% off of that. Any fundraising that goes on, any programs that come through the door, if you're going to use the NAACP name, you have to pay them to do that. So the branches are consistently trying to recruit people, and because they have not been a force in the community, it makes it difficult for people who come into the door to assist them or donate money at this level because they've been so inactive over the years.
Sounds more like a franchise.
That's exactly what it is. And so this franchise has gotten to the place that it's a money drain and it's a disservice to the people of color and all the communities across the country. We need a wake-up call. And the only reason why these things are happening is because we're not making any kind of conscious decisions on the people who we call leaders. So for me to have to do this, man, I love doing it because our people need help. But to see how the NAACP has become a puppet for the Democratic Party is really a disservice for black people because it's this simple. If the Democratic Party was the party and is the party that black people cater to, and their best interest is to the constituents in the black community, why are the black communities across the country that is under the Democratic leadership, why are our communities so tore up? Why are our communities last with everything? Why is the violence rate every day there's a head Sandy Hook here in Chicago? Why haven't somebody even on the international scene stepped in and said, America, what you're doing to black people is wrong, and hold America accountable in the war court for a Holocaust? Nobody is saying nothing. But that's my job as the president of this Living and Driving While Black Foundation That's what you're going to hear from me all across this country. And at the same time, organizations like the NAACP who do not do what the charter say that they do and get millions and millions of dollars in the insistent destruction of black people, I will expose them.
David Lowery's website is www.livingthrivingwhileblack.net.
President Obama made a great show of shedding tears on television following the mass murder of school children in Newtown, Connecticut. Dr. Johnny Williams is a professor of sociology at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He was not impressed by Obama's tearful performance.
I thought it's theater for the public. It was basically, it's an awful tragedy. But these tears were shed for a particular group of children, not for children overall. And since it's being shed for a particular group of children, I thought it's a double standard, because the violence that is endemic to America, the violence of America, the origins of America is immersed in violence itself. Violence is all around us, and it's been going on ever since Obama's been in office, especially in his home city of Chicago, where I'm sure more than 26 kids have lost their lives just during the year. But Obama has basically said nothing about that, has shed no tears about that, which I find to be very problematic.
Every time one of these mass murder events happens, we hear the punditry talk about America re-examining itself. But, well, white America never does seem to re-examine itself, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, and the thing about the media and this whole episode is that it seems to be delusional when it comes to asking the right questions about why it is that, say, white males are the predominant perpetrators of mass killings in the United States. And I think if they ask that basic question, then it'll lead them down another road. That is, the road is the question of white privilege, especially white male privilege. And, I mean, these killings occurred in a very affluent town, and this guy came from a very affluent family. And before he went out to kill the children, first he killed his mother. So obviously it seems to be some link to gender. That is, from my perspective, I mean, why did he kill his mother? He shot her in the head multiple times. And then he went to the school where I assume he went when he was a child. I guess he had some kind of memories about it. And he also shot the children multiple times. At least the reports were that there were three shots at minimum that he delivered into each body of the children, 3 to 11 shots. So, I mean, he had some kind of vehement kind of reaction to that. At least as a sociologist, what I'm thinking is that this is more than just about him just going out and just willy-nilly shooting people. This says something about, say, whiteness itself, from my perspective, given that especially white males feel like they're under assault in the United States, especially with the re-election of Barack Obama, even though, I mean, from my perspective, re-electing Barack Obama really didn't amount to much change at all, given that white males are pretty much still in charge, given that they, about 96 to 97% of them, run the Fortune 500 companies in the United States and these big global corporations around the world that affect our lives on a continuous basis in a very haphazard kind of way. But there is this perception that somehow that white people, beginning, you know, it started really with the Tea Party, with its reaction after Obama was elected, to say that they're somehow losing the country, simply because the country is becoming very much more racially and ethnically diverse. So they have this kind of reaction. And this has been going on for a while, though, since the country is starting to change. Mother Jones did an excellent piece documenting these guys in the trail that they've led since 2001 of these mass murderers and these white guys who are committing all these activities and so forth. And it seems to be heavily associated with racism itself. Like I said, white supremacy. This is about taking back something that they fear that they're losing that they never will get back. And they're probably correct, but is it the right way to go out to kill people, and even people who are white like themselves, to take back the country? The mentality is one where if I can't take back the country, I might as well kill myself and take a whole bunch of people with me. It's somewhat selfish. It's very immature, but it also is emblematic of what America is all about, even in foreign policy and so forth. If they can't have it, then they might as well just destroy it. That's our policy, pretty much.
When the larger society looked at the higher crime rates, including homicide rates in Black America, they ascribed that to a pathology of the ghetto, to somehow it being a symptom of Black cultural problems. But nobody talks about white culture and its problems, because it spawns these kinds of horrific acts.
Well, whiteness itself is normative, so nobody ever talks about it, because, I mean, it's everywhere. It's pervading the whole arena, so you don't have to talk about it. It just is. When people say, for instance, American, they assume that you're talking about a white American. You're not talking about anybody else but a white American, right? And so they don't have to think about that. And so in that way, then, they don't have to think about the violence that they themselves perpetrate. That is, you know, when you watch the news, when these criminals commit these kinds of activities, right, you don't see them putting their picture up on the screen for a good 30 seconds. They just say some man did it. The assumption is the man is white. But when they put somebody Black or Latino up there, they keep their picture up there for 30 seconds or so. So to be white is assumed to be pretty much law-abiding, perfect, and not a criminal, not pathological, and so forth. But in fact, it is that, though. As, like I said, as you referred to in your own piece in the Black Agenda Report, that this is endemic to America. From the get-go, America was involved in genocidal kind of behavior with taking over the country from Native American folk and so forth, right? And then bringing along African folk and then committing all kinds of genocides along the way during this process just for the sake of money. So it's all entwined with that. They don't really examine that. They don't even think about examining it. Rather, they think about examining the other. There's no, I don't know of any kind of scholarly piece that examines, say, white people wholesale, especially white upper-class people, like they do, say, when they examine the pathology of, say, Black folk, when they say we're pathological. So there's tremendous studies in the academy about us, but there's nothing about white pathology or whiteness itself. And that's one of the ways in which they kind of manufacture this myth that they themselves are not engaged in this kind of violent activity, which is endemic to their particular culture.
And certainly nothing about imperial pathology. New figures show that the United States carried out 333 drone attacks in Afghanistan alone this year. That's almost one every day.
Yeah, and actually I saw this statistic too, but what I saw was that it was 400 and something for 2012. And that is true. And then they're killing indiscriminately. They're not concerned about kids. And again, there was another piece that was put out, and it's called An Incomplete List of the Children Obama Has Killed with Drones. And the fact is that Obama, who, when he came to Newtown and spoke at the memorial, mentioned their names, individual and so forth, all the kids who died. But he doesn't talk about the kids who he killed on a daily basis, say in Pakistan or Yemen and so forth. And he just engaged in just another attack just on Christmas Eve that killed, I think, two and maybe five other folk. I don't know if they're civilian casualties or not, but the fact is that he's continuing these drone attacks that are indiscriminately killing people. And they refer to these civilian casualties as, you know, collateral damage, but also, according to the vernacular in their own computers, bug splat, dehumanizing people to the point, especially little children and older folk and so forth, as bug splat, not even human beings. So they're just the other. You can't mention their names because they're just the indiscriminate other, unlike what he was doing in, say, in Newtown, which is, for me, I found to be distasteful, disingenuous, and pretty much a tremendous double standard when it comes to people's humanity. You're killing human beings, and they all have a name, they all have a history and so forth, and you should recognize that you're doing that. But he seemed not to care one whit about that when, say, that is Obama, President Obama, when he shed his tears on TV, when he cracked up about what had happened to those kids. He didn't even do that for Trayvon Martin. Yeah, he mentioned, he could have been my son, but I didn't see him cracking up about it. I didn't see him cracking up about what's going on in, say, the urban areas when it comes to gun violence and so forth. But only when it came to this particular episode with these little kids did he crack up, which I find to be troubling in the present United States.
Professor Johnny Williams at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
The United States is the world capital of privately owned guns, part of the American legacy of slavery and racial genocide. Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Why does the U.S. Constitution guarantee a right to keep and bear arms? Why not the right to vote? Why not the right to a quality education, to health care, to a clean environment, or to a job? what was so important in early America about the rights of citizens to have guns? And is it even possible to have an honest discussion about gun control without acknowledging the racist origins of the Second Amendment? The dominant trend among legal scholars and on this current Supreme Court is that we are bound by the original intent of the Constitution's authors. Here's what the Second Amendment to the Constitution says. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Clearly, the authors of that passage aim to guarantee the right to a gun for every free white man in their new country. What's no longer evident 230 years later is why. The answer, advanced by historian Edmund Morgan in his classic work American Slavery, American Freedom, The Ordeal of Colonial Virginia, sheds useful light upon the historic and current politics and self-image of our nation. Colonial America and the early U.S. was a very unequal place. All the good, cleared, level agricultural land with easy access to transport was owned by a very few, very wealthy white men. Many poor whites were brought over as indentured servants, but having completed their periods of forced labor, allowing them to hang around the towns and cities landless and unemployed was dangerous to the social order. So they were given guns and credit, and sent inland to make their own fortunes by encroaching upon the orchards, the farms, and the hunting grounds of Native Americans who had little or no access to firearms. The law, of course, did not penalize white men who robbed, raped, or killed Indians. At regular intervals, colonial governors and local U.S. officials would muster the free armed white men as militia and dispatch them in murderous punitive raids to make the frontier safer for settlers and land speculators. Slavery remained legal in New England, New York, and the Mid-Atlantic region until well into the 1800s, and the movements of free blacks and Indians were severely restricted for decades afterwards. So, colonial and early American militia also prowled the roads and highways, demanding the passes of all non-whites to ensure that the enslaved or free blacks were not escaping or aiding those who were, and that free blacks and Indians were not plotting rebellion or traveling for unapproved reasons. Historically, then, the principal activities of the Founding Fathers' well-regulated militia were Indian killing, land stealing, slave patrolling, and the enforcement of domestic apartheid, all of these, as the constitutional language declares, being, quote, necessary to the security of a free state, unquote. A free state whose fundamental building blocks were the genocide of Native Americans and the enslavement of Africans. The constitutional sanction of universally armed white men against blacks and Indians is at the origin of what has come to be known as America's gun culture, and it neatly explains why that culture remains most deeply rooted in white, rural, and small-town America long after the end of slavery and the close of the frontier. With the genocide of Native Americans accomplished and slavery gone, America's gun culture wrapped itself in new clothing, in self-justifying mythology that construes the Second Amendment as arming the citizenry as the final bulwark of freedom against tyranny, invasion, or crime. Embracing this fake history of the Second Amendment warps legal scholarship and public debate in clouds of willful ignorance, encouraging us to believe that this is a nation found on just and egalitarian principles, rather than one built with stolen labor upon stolen land. Maybe that's how we can tell that we are so finally over all that nasty genocide and racism stuff, we've chosen to simply write it out of our history.
That was Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon in Atlanta. Renters make up the majority of residents in some of the nation's biggest cities, but get very little protection from arbitrary eviction. The National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty recently completed a study titled Eviction Without Notice, authored by attorney Tristia Baumann. We asked Baumann if neglect of tenants' rights is the result of an American obsession with private home ownership and white picket fences.
I definitely think that plays a large role. Home ownership is part of the American dream, and so the loss of that dream represented a crisis that perhaps losing a rental unit, since that group of folks are more mobile. Having said that, there's also a series of practical reasons why less attention has been paid to renters, and some of that is just a matter of obtaining data about them. Homeowners have to register their titles, and they're easier to track, whereas renters do not have to register their residency in the same way, and so it's difficult sometimes to track how many renters exist in a particular area. But you're correct in that in particularly urban areas, most of the people who are residing in the major cities are renters. And when they're renting foreclosed properties, they are suffering the loss of financial wealth and their possessions as well, but they have not been looked at in the same way as homeowners.
In fact, you say that 40% of the families that face evictions due to foreclosures are renters.
That's correct. The research shows that the 40% of families who are facing eviction are living in foreclosed rental properties. We know additionally from a recent report that there are 3 million children, meaning people under the age of 18 years old, who are at risk of losing their homes as a result of foreclosure on rental properties. So these numbers represent millions and millions of people and households who are at risk of homelessness and certainly at risk of housing instability as an ongoing consequence of the foreclosure crisis.
And so what represents a financial crisis to the landlord, possible loss of income, maybe some loss of property, amounts to loss of home for his tenants.
That's exactly right, and not just home. Security deposits are often prepaid. Sometimes there are prepaid rent amounts. When a landlord defaults, oftentimes the renter will find that the landlord will just abandon the property. And so in addition to not being able to find their landlord for necessary maintenance, they also are not going to be able to find the landlord for the return of their security deposit or prepaid rent. And that can be a very significant financial loss, particularly for low-income renters, because that amount represents a significant part or perhaps all of their savings that they would be able to spend toward finding new housing. There are other losses, financial losses, that come in the form of loss of property when people are forced to vacate a home either immediately or when they come home and the doors are locked, or when they're given some lesser period of time than is allowed under the PTFA, then they oftentimes have to sacrifice many of their belongings. And the disruption may cause unintended financial losses, like, for example, the termination of their employment if they are no longer able to commute, or the disruption of their schooling, or the disruption of their medical assistance or childcare. So there are any number of negative consequences that face renters in foreclosed properties outside of the loss of their home.
And you made mention of the PTFA, and that's the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, which your report says is all that stands between housing and homelessness for a huge number of people.
That's correct. The Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act was passed in 2009 and then extended in 2010 and is currently set to expire at the end of 2014. So unless it is extended beyond that date, it's only going to be in effect to protect the millions of renters and foreclosed properties until 2014. What it does is primarily two things. One, it provides that a lease, a bona fide lease, and bona fide leases are defined very broadly to include most leases, survives foreclosure. What that means is when your rental property is foreclosed upon, you are permitted, provided that you do not break the terms of the lease, to remain in that property for the duration of your lease agreement under those same lease terms, meaning at the rent that you had agreed to pay, in the condition that you had agreed to rent it, for the duration of time that you had agreed to rent the property. The second thing that the PTFA does is provide that in any instance, like for example, if someone has no written lease agreement or no lease agreement at all and just happens to be living in a rental property, provided that they meet the criteria for being a bona fide tenant, is entitled to no less than 90 days written notice before they can be forced to vacate the home. And those 3 months we find are critical in order to allow renters and foreclosed properties to locate and afford new housing.
Are most tenants aware of their rights under the PTFA?
Well, what we have found is that some are and some are not. In a national survey that was conducted by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, which is where I work, we surveyed 156 tenants as well as 227 tenant advocates. And most of those tenant advocates are legal services attorneys, legal aid attorneys, and other advocates who represent tenants in foreclosed properties. And what they reported is that some of their clients knew, some of the responding tenants knew about the PTFA, but many did not. And when they were unaware of it, they were much more vulnerable to having their rights violated at a great cost to them.
We see in times of crisis a large turnover among owners, but that creates great problems for the tenants who remain behind.
That's right. Part of the problem that is unique to this foreclosure crisis as we're experiencing it now is that new owners are often not individual entities. New owners are financial institutions that do not make good landlords and that are not equipped to provide the type of necessary maintenance, oversight, and management that a rental property would require. And this creates a series of other issues for renters in foreclosed properties who are struggling to find how they're going to get their utilities turned back on or struggling to find a way to get their plumbing or air conditioning or heating repaired. And that's a function of the type of new ownership that we're seeing.
We don't see the mention of the term predatory landlord in your report, but that's a phenomenon that became quite dramatic during the crisis. And that is those speculative landlords who buy buildings with the express purpose of changing the demographic complexion of the tenants.
That's right. So we do in the report, we didn't touch much on the fraud that led to the financial crisis. We were really looking primarily at two different things. One, the ongoing violations of the PTFA to establish that the PTFA does need more time, because when it is raised as a defense in an eviction or raised in response to an illegal notice to vacate, it is effective. Also, we were looking at the ways that individual states have or have not, in most cases, stepped up to protect tenants renting in foreclosed properties within their jurisdictions, what sort of state-level protections are available. We did not look a lot at what contributed to the foreclosure crisis in the first place, but we know that there was significant predatory lending, and we know that there was a disproportionate impact on low-income and minority neighborhoods. And that's true not only for homeowners, but also for renters. We know through research that there are a higher proportion of minority renters. We also know that foreclosed rental properties in minority neighborhoods frequently receive less maintenance. So you're finding that properties are being allowed to languish longer. They're dilapidating, and the result is blocks of ruined, neglected properties.
We should also note that as this housing crisis built and finally burst, the effort to close down public housing across the country continued unabated.
Well, that's right. I mean, there has been this idea that mixed income housing is the best model. And I would not say that I disagree with that in theory, but in practice, what we have found, like, for example, in Miami, what we have found is that public housing or low-income housing would be torn down with the promise that mixed-income housing would then be developed, but it was never developed. Some of that may be a function of the credit freeze that accompanied the foreclosure crisis. Some of it was a function just of pure fraud. But the result is that you have eliminated even more affordable housing options for those who desperately need them. And in the current market, where rental properties are becoming more and more the norm and increasing, you see this concurrent inflation of rental prices, particularly in crowded rental markets like in major cities, and the homes that are affordable to low-income and extremely low-income people are shrinking in volume and doing so rapidly, which is contributing to a rising level of homelessness in America.
In fact, you note that the population of renters has been increasing. In fact, it was increasing before this crisis, and with the high level of evictions, another boost to the rental population.
That's right. There was a recent survey showing that since 2000, the total number of renters in America has increased by 5.1 million people. And we expect to see that increase. And in 2010, renters made up the majority of households in several of our nation's most populous cities.
And finally, of course, your report had a set of recommendations.
That's right. We recommend several different things. First and foremost among them is that the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, which is the only federal response to protect renters at the national level, needs to be made permanent. We are not out of the woods when it comes to the foreclosure crisis. In fact, it's speculated to be a minimum of another 5 years before we bottom out. And that means that increased numbers of renters and future renters are going to be affected by this crisis. Beyond that, we do need to add in an express private right of action. And what that means is when someone's rights are violated under the PTFA, like, for example, if they come home and the locks are changed and they're barred from being able to get into their properties, even though they had valid lease agreements and were paying the rent regularly and abiding by the terms of their lease, currently they're unable to sue for damages for what they have lost. An express private right of action would allow for suit, which would be a powerful deterrent for anybody who would violate the PTFA, and also provide some relief for people who have suffered dramatic losses as a result of the violations that we know continue to occur. We also think that there needs to be additional oversight. There's not one federal agency that regulates and implements the PTFA. We think that one federal agency should be authorized to do so and to provide guidance on how it should be implemented. And with those positive changes, we think that that would be a significant help that the federal government would be providing for renters in foreclosed properties. Secondarily, states can and should provide additional protections addressing areas that are not contemplated by the PTFA, which really just, like I said, governs those two main areas with respect to lease survival and 90 days minimum notice. There are several other problems that are suffered by renters in foreclosed properties, including problems with habitability. Some of these units are unfit for human life, problems with return of security deposits. There are some states that have provided for notice of an impending foreclosure, giving the tenant even more time to start making plans and saving for a potential housing disruption. All of these can and should be passed by the states, and that's another primary recommendation of our report. One thing I do want to add, just to emphasize the magnitude of the problem, while it's true that 40% of families facing eviction due to foreclosure are renters, and that has stayed a steady percentage over the past 3 years, the real numbers, the raw numbers of families that actually affects has tripled. This is a growing crisis. The feds do still need to be part of it, and the states need to do their part as well.
In decades past, we had a national tenant organization with chapters all around the country and other tenant organizations. We had ACORN, which used to do grand work in terms of stabilizing neighborhoods for both homeowners and for renters, but it's gone by the wayside. Who speaks for tenants nationally these days?
You know, right now, there are three national organizations, the National Law Center, also the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and the National Housing Law Project, that have devoted a considerable amount of time and energy to bring new owners into voluntary compliance, to work with federal agencies to make sure that the PTFA is being abided by, and also to educate and train legal service providers such that they are aware how to raise the PTFA as a defense and eviction action or as a response to an illegal notice. But the large-scale tenant unions have not, at least in my experience, played a large role. What we are seeing, however, are statewide tenant organizations that have been very successful and helpful in particular jurisdictions. And one that immediately comes to mind is Tenants Together in California. They have a hotline as well as a series of other resources available for renters in foreclosed properties. And a model like that should be replicated in other parts of the country.
And that's it for this New Year's edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Rudd.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.